This is an ABC podcast.
Dr. Tracy Westerman is a proud Ngaimal woman from the Pilbara region of Western Australia. She spent her early years at a place with the amazing name of Useless Loop, then moved to the mining town of Tom Price. Tracy became the first person educated in Tom Price to go on to university. And when she arrived in Perth, Tracy had never caught a bus or ridden an escalator. But she was fired with a passion to study psychology so that she could help her mob. She wanted to deliver mental health care that was useful and practical to Aboriginal people, care that took account of the psychological effects of dispossession and trauma, and most importantly, mental health that would help stem the terrible tide of suicide in Aboriginal communities. Tracy became the first Aboriginal person to complete a combined master's and PhD in clinical psychology. She set up her own business at 26 and later founded the Westerman Gillier Institute for Indigenous Mental Health. Tracy's awards include an Order of Australia, Telstra Women's Business Award, and a WA Australian of the Year. And now that she's achieved all that, Tracy's vision is to build an army of Indigenous psychologists, an army of people like her. Her new memoir is called Gillier. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Sarah. You've made me a bit emotional hearing all that backstory.
It's quite a lot, to put in an introduction. Mm. Is there truly a place called Useless Loop, Tracy? And did you truly live there?
Well, because it's a memoir, they had to fact check it, right? So, yeah, there actually is, and it's just, you couldn't make it up if you tried. It's just such an incredible, you know, thing to say, particularly in international keynote presentations. It gets lots of laughs. But Useless Loop is, yeah, it's in the near the beautiful Shark Bay in the Murchison area there in Western Australia, and it's just idyllic, you know, essentially, just absolutely beautiful.
Your mum and dad had been working on stations before that. Where were they living before you came along?
So Dad came from Collie, and so his background was a little bit different to Mum's in that, you know, a white fella. And then he ended up in the Goldfields region. His dad sort of was from Glasgow, Scotland originally, and him and his mum and dad split up quite young, and it seemed to be that it's just quite a random division of you'll take the boys and I'll take the girls sort of thing. So Dad ended up with his mum and stepdad, and ended up in Port Hedland with everything that he owned in the back of his ute. Mum was obviously a born and bred Ngaimal woman from the Pilbara, and so was already there. So they sort of got together.
How did they first meet?
Oh, look, it's a great story. You know, like Mum, depending on which side of the story you listen to, of course, or believe, Mum's version of it is that she was working in the Port Hedland pub as a pretty well-to-do job for, you know, an Aboriginal woman of that generation. And she'd finish work at about midnight, and Dad had spotted her and fallen completely and utterly in love from a distance. Couldn't approach her at all because he was just so overwhelmed with how beautiful she is and was. And so she would say that she'd finished work and she'd see these lights go on and Dad's car, and he'd follow her home, you know, to make sure she was safe, which I always jokingly say sounds all very romantic, but I think they call that stalking, Dad. just to put a fine point on it, you know. So he was just completely besotted with her from the moment he met, and their love story is quite an extraordinary one, really.
He would bring flowers home to your mum in the Pilbara. Where was he getting them?
No idea how he pulled that one off, but he managed to do it. And I think the thing with those two is Mum grew up and she had to be quite hard and she had to be quite tough, obviously, to live through what she did as an Aboriginal woman. And Dad somehow managed to just completely maintain his softness. And so between the two of them, Dad had the biggest heart, and he would just hug you to the point you'd almost, you know, the circulation in your body would almost, you know, stop circulating around your body. So he had this massive amount of love that he just had to give. And Mum would just feign embarrassment all the time, but of course she loved it. So the combination of them was just incredible as kids to watch.
Your dad used to claim he was 6 foot tall, Tracy. Was that true?
No, he told Mum that he was 6 foot four, could play the guitar, 6 foot tall, could play the guitar and was part Aboriginal, none of which was true. And it was all obviously to try and, you know, win Mum's affections. So, no, none of that was true.
He did have a dog that was unusual for a ringer like him to have. What kind of dog did he have?
So he had a Cocker Spaniel, and I've still got two. So we've always had Cockers. And my dad was a tough station man, carved out of granite, literally. And he had tough tattoos and all the rest of it. And, of course, all the station guys had their blue heelers and their, you know, appropriate dogs, the Kelpies and so forth. And Dad would have his little cute little Cocker Spaniel called Bobo. Now, the reason why he had Bobo was because he had no family and he arrived in Port Hedland and the Aboriginal community just loved him and took him in. And they said, this man doesn't have a family, he doesn't have a woman, we better get him a dog. And so they got him this, just strangely, the local copper had a litter of puppies that were mostly crossbred Cocker Spaniels. And so the joke was that you couldn't find Mick Westerman, you find Bobo. And so Bobo was his lucky shadow. So we've always had Cocker Spaniels ever since.
He was a hardworking man. What did his hands look like? Like when he'd go to use the phone, how would he stick one of those fingers in a dial-up phone?
He'd have to use a pen. So back in the day, you'd have, of course, the dial phones, right? So Dad's hands were so massive from all the years and years of manual labour. He had to get a pen out to actually dial the phone. So, and Dad was one of those people that was always curious. He was always inquisitive, and he wasn't an educated man by any stretch, but, you know, both Mum and Dad would be up at 4 a.m. working, and that's just who they were. And so they modelled that for all of us kids, and you don't really realise the luck of that, to have that as models in front of you. Dad was, I would actually say, I've met some really intelligent people in my life, like highly educated people, but they're not wise. My dad was wise, and he always knew there was no ambiguity in Dad in terms of what was right and wrong. He was a man of very few words, unlike myself. I'm a person of very many words. But, yeah, he just always modelled all those great values.
What about your mum, Tracy? Where had she grown up?
So she was in Port Hedland. I've spent all of her life there, really, until she met Dad. And, I don't know, they were really specific and deliberate in terms of what they did. Every choice they made was to try and give us kids a better life. So the first thing they did was worked on stations. And then, of course, Mum, as an Aboriginal woman, wasn't paid. So it was just room and board for her. And so when more kids came, they sort of went, OK, we now need to go to useless loop. So that was the salt mine, which gave Dad a wage and better opportunities. And then Tom Price. And so when you look back, you go, and that's what I'm talking about in terms of people being wise. And also being so focused on, fundamentally, I want my kids to have a better life than I had. I want my kids to struggle less. And so you see those very deliberate choices now as an adult, you know.
What had happened to your mum when she was just 9?
So this is a really tough story, this one. And that story, it was so powerful, Sarah, because Mum only told me that story 3 years ago. And I'd never heard it. She'd never told me this story. And I was actually starting to write the memoir. And that story was of Mum being in Marble Bar as a kid with her mum and dad. And the welfare came and told her parents that she was unwell and had to be taken to Port Hedland. And she wasn't unwell, of course. She was being, you know, in the process of being forced to be removed. So she was put on a small plane, and all she could remember was her mum screaming and being held up by auntie. She had no concept of what was going on. And so obviously what they were doing was taking her to Port Hedland on the plane, which was 180 kilometres away from Marble Bar. And she, when she first started telling me this story, she couldn't stop saying to me, why was I on that plane, Tracy? Why was I on that plane? And she just kept going over and over and over again, and Mum's in her 80s now. And it's almost like when people can't make sense of traumatic events, they have to repeat them again and again and again to try and make sense of something that doesn't make any sense. So she did that a lot. And the story, how it ended, is the most powerful story, and that was that her dad, she was in the dorm. She ended up getting to the dorm in Port Hedland, which is obviously where all the kids would go when they were about to be put into missions. And she was woken up in the middle of the night by her dad, Murphy, who had managed to find his way all the way from Marble Bar to Port Hedland. And he picked her up and he carried her all the way back home through the mangroves, through the heat, through everything, to get her back home to Marble Bar. And so the reason why that story is so powerful is because there are many, many thousands and thousands of Murphy balls that we'd never, ever hear about. And Aboriginal people were told that your parents don't care about you, they gave you up. But the most important part of that story is that so much about life is luck or bad luck. And so Murphy Ball's love for his daughter generationally saved us all. It saved our future. It's completely different because of the actions of a father's love. The fact that he found her and brought her home but it sickens me how close she came to forced removal. And where would I be now, and where would my siblings be now, had it not been for the love of Murphy Ball to find his daughter and bring her home?
How did that play out, that experience, and then I guess that fear that you could be taken again at any point? How did that play out in the way she raised you and your sibling?
It's really interesting. So our house looked like a hospital, literally looked like a hospital. It was scrubbed to an inch of its life. Looking back now as an adult, you realise what that anxiety was around, because it was anxiety, and all of us have anxiety, every single one of us in the family. You know, I was a very, very white, you know, vanilla. My hair was so white, and Mum's quite dark. So you can just imagine, you know, being an Aboriginal woman in a remote mining town with a very, very fair-skinned kid. The anxiety in her would have been palpable. But, of course, what parents do is they protect their children from things that children shouldn't have to worry about. We were also the only kids at school that wore school uniform. We were honestly starched to within an inch of our lives. So Mum living at home was lovely, but it was like a boot camp. If you woke up at 1 minute past six, there was no breakfast. You know, it was like that. It was really structured, and it was. But you understand now that there was that fear that if there was any reason that the house was untidy or anything like that, then one of us kids could have easily been removed from the family. So that's how it manifested in her.
When one of you encountered racism in that community, was that something your mum would call out head on?
Oh, yeah. And I'm laughing, Sarah.
She wasn't anxious about that.
I'm laughing, Sarah, because even now I cringe. You know, like I'm a grown woman and I still cringe because my mum, oh my goodness. And these days you'd call her fierce, right? And she is fierce, and she would take on racism like nobody I've ever seen. And when we were kids, we'd be embarrassed. We'd be like, oh my God, how embarrassing, Mum, like this. But there was also a part of you that just felt so proud because she never, ever, ever not believed us. And there's nothing worse than a kid coming to your parent with any sort of pain and their parent not believing you. Mum was never like that. And so she took it on. And, you know, Mum's 5'11", 10'11", like me. So she's tall and she's black. So you can just imagine her taking on, you know, people on around racism. But looking at that through young eyes and a kid's eyes was pretty extraordinary to watch.
What did she do for work in Tom Price?
She cleaned. She cleaned, and she scrubbed floors and she scrubbed floors and she scrubbed floors for 30, 40 years. And she did that so that us kids could have a better life than she had. Mm.
So how do you, growing up there, Tracy, in that mining town out in the Pilbara, get the idea to want to be a psychologist? Did you know any psychologists?
No. I never even met one in my life. So it's fair to say the odds were fairly stacked against me, Sarah. I mean, no one on either side of my family had ever been inside of a university. Mum and Dad had year three education, so I couldn't go home and say, hey, Mum and Dad, help me with my homework, because their literacy was pretty basic. And, of course, the school was just up to year 10, and then beyond that, not really much. Everyone was working it was obviously a mining town, so the school was really geared around, you know, people being either tradespeople or secretaries.
So how did you first hear about there being such a thing as a psychologist?
Because there was an occupations finder that Centrelink used to bring out once a year, and alphabetical order, and I went through it. And I don't know why I went through it. I was about 13, 14, and saw a psychiatrist. Went, no, I don't think I like that one. Oh, there's not the sound about a psychologist. Oh, that sounds interesting. And I liked the description of it. And I thought, yeah, I think I'll do that.
It was about people, I guess, about working with people. 100%. Was that what grabbed you?
Yeah, look, when I was a little kid, Mum used to always jokingly say whenever Tracy goes missing, she'd say up at the Blackfella camp. They're the words that she would use. And that's because I love the yarns. I love the stories. And so I'd be sitting there and I was as white can be. So they call me the Milky Bar Kid, right? And so I'd be in this camp, you know, listening to all these stories with these big blue eyes like this. And I think from the very start, I just was always interested in the stories, and I was always interested in people. It's just so interesting. So I think absolutely it was such an obvious thing when I read it that, yeah, that's of course what I want to do.
So tell me about that moment when you opened the envelope with your year 12 results.
I can still feel the heartbeat going even now, Sarah, all these years later, hey, because it was a big deal, you know, like it was, you know, I was pretty obsessed which is clearly a character trait. I was pretty obsessed with getting into university, and I would study, and then fall asleep with all of my,
Doing this by distance.
Education. Yeah. So I essentially had to educate myself. So there was no teacher. So distance education, they send your stuff down to you from Perth, your coursework, and you complete the coursework by yourself. And then I'd send it back to Perth and you'd get your mark back. And I met my teacher twice in 2 years during year 11 and 12. And, so when I got into university, and I still remember the postie, you know, the sound of the postie. I miss that sound of the postie. The postie would come and I knew it was that day, you know, and I got the letter. And you know how you have those moments where your legs just start going to jelly and you just, I opened it up and there it was. And I knew the mark that I needed. And I think I got 30 points or thereabouts more than I needed. So it was a big moment.
Getting into university meant moving to the big snow, to Perth. How did you end up on a mammoth bus trip one day, Tracy?
Oh, look, I was a bit of fun for everybody because everyone like, what's she done today? Because I don't think anyone had ever met anyone like me, you know. It was like I'd landed from planet Mars and because no one could actually understand how could no one, how is it possible that someone has never seen a traffic light before? How's that a thing? And so, I jumped on the bus and I didn't know what to do. And so I ended up, I was in Perth in Nedlands and I ended up down in Fremantle, which is about half an hour past my stop. And I was too ashamed to push the little button thing. And I thought everyone was so brave how they just pushed the little button when they didn't make the bus stop. And so I ended up, quite a few times just going on these big massive trips around Perth just because it was so overwhelming to me.
How long did it take to get used to the city?
I don't think it's ever really changed, even now. Like, to be honest, I go to Sydney and Melbourne and I still wait for everyone else to cross the road and I follow them in a pack. So I don't, I'm like sheep, how they stick together in a herd. I'm exactly like that. So I don't cross the road by myself in big cities because I'm not brave enough. So nothing's really changed very much.
So you were studying psychology as an undergraduate. How often was the word Aboriginal mentioned in that undergraduate degree?
Not for about 3 years of the undergraduate degree. So at that stage, the statistics were pretty appalling already, with incarceration rates amongst the world's highest, suicide rates double that of non-Indigenous Australia, child removals amongst, I don't know how far it was back then, but it was about at least double the rate. And expecting to come down to university and learn all this amazing stuff and be armed with all this knowledge, and the word Aboriginal wasn't mentioned once in 3 years. We are invisible in the training and invisible most places.
Not surprisingly, you didn't feel particularly engaged by that undergraduate degree. Where did you get a job after uni?
Look, the best thing that ever happened to me was, which sounds like a bizarre thing to say, I got a job with child welfare, really, and they sent me to Kalgoorlie. I had my brother there at the School of Mines, so he was studying mining engineering, so I thought, okay, at least I'll be next to some family. And I was going out to all of the Western Desert communities as a 22-year-old kid, which I look back now and I go, that's just, I don't know whether it's brave or insane, in terms of the sorts of things that I was facing every day as a kid. But the Western Desert and Kalgoorlie people saved me. They saved me because I would not have actually gone back into psychology had it not been for their love and their warmth and also the fact that I implicitly and instinctually then convinced myself through working in those really complex communities that I was capable of doing it.
Mm. One of the things you were encountering in the Western Desert was how Aboriginal ways of understanding experience can conflict with mainstream psychology and psychiatry. How did that play out with people experiencing visions, hearing voices, seeing ghosts, which in mainstream psychology would probably be labelled psychosis?
Yeah, so this is actually really big in terms of what we call these things loosely, Sarah. We call them culture-bound syndrome. So it's really important to have a name for things, right? Because when they have a name for them, then people start to understand and then, unpack from there. But, 22 years of age and you'd have people that look like they were floridly psychotic. On top of it, you also had solvent abuse, which was really massive in Warburton, where I ended up. So, of course, you have a 500%, I think, increase in alcohol and drug-induced psychoses amongst some vulnerable Indigenous populations. So you've got that bit. And then you've got some people who may actually be psychotic. So trying to unpack those three levels of complexity.
How did you approach it practically? You had two lists.
Yeah, I had two lists. I actually got a bit of a notepad out and I wrote similar and then I wrote different. And I wrote, how is what I'm saying similar to someone who's psychotic and how is what I'm saying different? And essentially what you do as a psychologist is you weigh up the balance of probabilities, essentially, and you formulate a diagnosis is what we talk about. And so essentially what I was trying to create here was an evidence base of difference. If you get assessment wrong, you get treatment wrong, you make things worse. But it was really hard to advocate for something that the profession didn't accept was real.
So once you've drawn up that list to make clear to yourself and then to colleagues and clients, I guess, what might be happening with an Aboriginal client who was having a vision, hearing voices, what might be different? Where was there something different culturally that wasn't fitting, you know, a diagnosis of schizophrenia or psychosis or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing is that the triggers have to be there. So if you've got someone, for example, who's having a spiritual visit with someone who's passed away, often they've had a death and often that death's been unresolved. And so often their spiritual visits manifest as really troubling experiences. And so what that means is that something's been missed in the grief process. So if it's a cultural issue, cultural treatment, things get better. So essentially they'll have to go through cultural grieving or cultural processes, and then your outcome is that the visits then become comforting to the individual, right? Now, if you jump in there and you make that clinical in terms of this person's psychotic, get assessment wrong, get treatment wrong, make things worse. And so essentially you'd medicate someone. And this is what we're finding consistently and all too much in Aboriginal communities. People would get worse or the symptoms wouldn't dissipate. So, of course, from the perspective of the, monocultural mental health system, antipsychotics treatments are best practice. So that means that we have to up the medication so the therapeutic dose isn't correct. And so things would continue to get worse. Okay, we'll up the medication, things would get worse. And so often that was when people would come to me and go, look, we just don't think it's right. We don't think that they're not what the psychiatrist is saying. And so that's just one example. The other one that we have is people who are sung or cursed. And this is something that's very real in lots of Indigenous communities where people can look as if their thoughts or believe that their thoughts are controlled by an outside source. Now, that is a form of payback. And so essentially that also looks like a command hallucination. And it gets really, really, really complicated. But essentially what happens is people, if they've transgressed culture, the solution is to go through a process of making up for that transgression as opposed to, you know, a mainstream mental health treatment.
So the right treatment in those circumstances would be cultural treatment.
Correct, yeah. And you've also got other things such as longing for country, which is, looks like clinical depression. Essentially when people are removed from land, country and people, they look clinically depressed. We've had to learn how to address cultural issues in a mainstream environment, which has been really challenging and fun.
So as a baby psychologist back in your 20s, you realised that you were really uniquely placed to be sensitive to these cultural realities along with the mainstream Western psychological framework that you'd been trained in. And you felt inspired and motivated to go back to uni and did a master's and then your PhD. You were at the same time working as a psychologist registrar to pay the bills. And you decided to rebuild a house. Tracy Westerman, how good did you get it at DIY in that period?
Oh, I got pretty good. In fact, I think if I wasn't a psychologist, I'd be a builder, right? And typical me that I can't do anything by half measures, right, Sarah? So everyone thought I was just building a little tiny shed in the the back. I bought this 1927 weatherboard home that was just, the worst house in the best street. And to the point that my family would come and visit me in Perth and they'd cry when they were driving home because of how bad the house was. And I'm like, how's my house? How awesome is my house? And I was so proud of it. And they'd be going, yeah, it's great, Trace. And then, of course, I spent 6 years renovating it. And I'm talking not having a functioning toilet, not having electricity. It was bad.
But it all worked out because what did you put in the middle of the backyard?
The Kath and Kim, are you talking about the Kath and Kim spa here? Like, you're talking about the Kath and Kim spa.
What else could I be asking you about but the Kath and Kim spa in the backyard?
I had to have one. And even to this day, I stand here and say that was the best thing. That was the coolest thing that I've ever had in my backyard. It was great.
Did you install that yourself?
Or
did
of course. I did everything myself. I had no money, Sarah. I had no option. I installed everything myself.
What did your mum think about that spa?
Oh, look, she read about this. Don't you love mums? They're just the best, aren't they? So I had a heater in the spa. Of course, you've got to have a heater in the spa. And so I'd quite often be sitting in the spa just having a nice cold beer at the end of a long, hard day of work, manual labour. And mum would ring up and she said, Tracy, I've just been reading about these people in Queensland they fell asleep in this, but it's a horrible story. She goes, and they almost drowned and, you know, blah, 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 and this is really bad, and I hope you're not drinking beer in that spa. And I said, of course not, Mum, as I'm taking a drink, of course not, Mum. So, yeah, but she was very concerned about that spa.
I'm glad you're sitting here in front of me then, Tracy. And, you know, even this wasn't enough. You decided to make good on your dream to start your own business.
Yes.
How many Aboriginal people did you know who'd done that, who'd started their own business?
Let me think about that for a minute. None. That would be none. I think I was a unicorn then, and I was a unicorn for a long time. You know, I really can't think of another Indigenous person in private practice, and certainly not one for as long as I've been in private practice for. So, yeah, I was a unicorn.
Why was that so important to you? You could have worked in university or in government. Why did you want your own business?
I was working in the public service at Child Protection. I was there 7 years. And I had all these great ideas. I would come into the executives and I'd say, hey, I'm just about finished a PhD. I'll be the first in Australia. The things that I'm finding out can change the country, can change whole communities. And they would say, oh, you know what, Trace, it doesn't really fit our policies. You know, it doesn't really fit this policy or that policy. And I just went, I just can't take this anymore. I actually can't take it, because I knew that unless we got into whole communities and built skills from the ground up, we were going to continue to just be putting out the spot fires of the outcomes of generations of forced removal and trauma. And so I just said, no, look, if I don't have a go at this, I'll always be that person who never had a go. And so I quit and started my own business.
When you began your own business, what was the most urgent issue that you felt needed to be addressed in terms of Aboriginal mental health?
I mean, obviously the suicides. You know, we'd, at that stage, we had double the rate, and that's been generationally. Now it's getting up to, you know, even worse, 2.5 to 3 times the rate. Certain regions carry the burden more than others, but at that stage it was double the rate. And the government response to it was just disgraceful. You'd have all these things that were occurring for non-Indigenous people, you know, prevention programs and all these initiatives and so forth. And then you'd have, say, a newspaper article and it would say, an Aboriginal people have double the rate, and then you'd have a full stop. And then you'd go, where's all the interventions and prevention programs? So it was something that I just couldn't ignore.
And those rates are shockingly even worse when it comes to children, which, as you say, children and suicide are not two words that should ever be in the same sentence.
Yeah, they shouldn't belong in a sentence, child and suicide. And we have, you know, probably the most horrific statistics, Sarah, is that, you know, every time an Indigenous child dies in this country, 40% of them will do so by suicide. This is Australia's children here. These are 10-year-old children that are choosing the option of death instead of life in our own backyards. And it's not okay.
When you began investigating and gathering data about what was behind these outrageous statistics, did you find that the causes are the same for when a non-Aboriginal and an Aboriginal person take their own life?
Yeah, no, they were very different. And this is where, I guess, I look back now, Sarah, and the profession didn't like me, and they still kind of don't to a certain extent. I'm a real outlier in the psychology profession, because what they assumed was that Indigenous people had the same causes of suicide than non-Indigenous. But to me, fundamentally, it didn't explain it, because why then do we have such an overrepresentation? The indicators or the causal pathways have to be different to explain the overrepresentation. So no one had actually bothered to check and explore things from the ground up. And that's not just in Australia, it's also in New Zealand and also in Canada. People just assume that, you know, a non-Indigenous person's causal drivers to suicide were the same as Indigenous. And so I developed the first, world's first psychometric screening tools based on going out to Aboriginal people who'd had lived experience and literally saying, what are the sorts of things you notice as a build-up to an act of suicide?
What did you find out?
It was highly impulsive. Non-Indigenous people tend to have depression and comorbid with alcohol and drug use in about 90% of cases. Now, that's actually really vital, because if we understand the why, which is the causal pathway, then that explains the what to do, which the treatments are best practice. The idea being, Sarah, if you eliminate a cause, you eliminate the end result, i.e. the suicides. So they've shown in mainstream that if you eliminate depression as a known causal pathway to suicide, you can actually eliminate 50% of suicide deaths, right? So it's critical that we understand causal pathways. So what we did was we just checked to see whether it was different or whether it was... And we didn't know we were going to find differences, but it was probably worth checking in terms of what people are saying. Highly impulsive, but that's very, very common with people who have trauma. So people who have trauma and attachment loss, which is obviously the origin is forced removal, tend to look like they overreact to critical events. So they'll go from 0 to 1,000 in 2 seconds, right?
And like a relationship breakup,
correct,
or something,
yeah,
like that can,
yeah,
can spur someone to,
yeah,
take that action.
Which kind of makes sense, because if you have forced removal, of course you pass that, your ability to attach to your own children and to form healthy, robust adult relationships can become compromised. And then, of course, what you do is you pass that on through biology, genetics and environmental modelling, you pass that on to your own kids. And so that's what we're sort of finding, Sarah, is that those sorts of maladaptive strategies, for want of a better phrase, in relation to conflict, is just getting passed through generations and of families. And so once we'd actually unpacked that in terms of determining difference, then, of course, the next step was to figure out, how do we fix it? Well, we fix it by teaching people distress tolerance skills. Do we fix it by teaching people, the ability to problem solve, to anger reduce, all those sorts of things? But you don't do it in the kids. You do it in the generation that actually passed the compromised attachment on. You do it in whole groups. And so that's what I talked about earlier, about getting into whole communities, whole critically affected communities, and fixing that generational progression and transference of risk, which is now what we know doesn't affect every Aboriginal person. It affects certain communities and certain families, more than others. And so they carry the burden of all the risk.
You do a lot of role play when running workshops in communities. As you say, you've got this focus on a community-wide act of prevention rather than on just an individual level. Give me an example of a scenario that you might use in a role play and how that could be useful.
Oh, I love this question. I love this question because what I lived every single day is to get out to remote communities, Sarah. I love training practitioners, of course, but you take me to a remote community, I'm just pumped, right? And often it's challenging. It's not for the faint-hearted. There's quite often the case, we'll have 3 or 4 language interpreters in the room. So you find people that can impart complex stuff like suicide risk assessment and conflict resolution, all those sorts of things, to people that have English as a second, third language. And so what we do, a couple of scenarios we use. One was lots of fun. It was a conflict resolution one. And we did a role play, and I said to my co-worker, I said, just pretend you don't like me. And they go, but I like you. And I just pretend you don't like me. Don't like my shoes, whatever. Just go full tilt at me. And so I just lost the plot, And then the community was sort of sitting there watching, and I said, okay, do it again, and did it again. And then I modelled really calming, soothing conflict resolution strategies. What we have is just really key, really simple messaging in terms of the type of strategies that I use. But then we get the community to go, what was different about the first one compared to the second one? So everything has to be visual and role-played, and people need to be able to see what good conflict resolution looks like and what bad conflict resolution looks like, and particularly in communities where the vast majority of people have never learnt those skills. You have to teach them, right? We also do a lot of stuff with kids where we use sports as a medium to develop coping strategies, which means that, if you play basketball or whatever, the pulse mimics anger. So we actually get kids to actually learn, who have really poor impulse control. We actually get them to play basketball, get their pulses up. Now, okay, one stop, get your pulse back down to normal. And then we might do complex puzzles and get them to see how their cognitions or their thought processes are actually improved when their heart rate comes down, right? So there's all these really cool little real-life scenarios that we use, but they're actually in the communities themselves. So we're not taking people outside of the communities that create the risk in the first place and the environment that created the risk in the first place. We're teaching it in the environment and also with whole groups of families and whole groups of siblings, so that the principle is that if you change the environment, you change the outcome.
Tell me about an older gentleman who approached you at the end of a workshop you were giving on sexual abuse to a woman's group.
Yeah, this is a beautiful older gentleman who came at the doing a workshop on sexual abuse with the women. And he came at the end of the workshop and he just stood down silently down the back of the room, and he just straight away, you just knew he had a story to tell. And I took about a good hour to say goodbye to the ladies and eventually get to him. By the time I got to him, he just burst into tears, and he was cowboy hat, tough-looking guy, seen many years of manual labour and hard work, but he clearly desperately wanted to say something. So I gave him the space, and he said, that stuff that you've been talking about, and he goes, that happened to me, the sexual abuse. And this is the thing about the privilege and honour of being a psychologist, is that you get to experience that vulnerability and pain in people and the privilege of hearing that every single day, you know. And so I said, it's okay, mate, I got you. What's brought you here today? Like, why today? And he said, I've just had my first granddaughter. And I said, oh, what's the significance of that? And he said, well, you know, I was abused myself and I was told by the people who abused me in the missions that I'd become a sex offender just like them. There's a lot of shame in being a victim, and that's what perpetrators rely on to maintain your silence. And for this beautiful man, he'd kept that secret for well over 70 years. And I said to him, look, I need to, let's debunk this myth right here. There is no evidence to support the abused automatically becomes an abuser in every circumstance. If that were the case, more women would be sex offenders because more women are victims. So he, as I sort of spoke to him, he sort of, you know, people who have extraordinary amounts of trauma and become, build incredible lives despite it. And this man was like that. Despite all this trauma, he married his childhood sweetheart, had five beautiful kids who were all exceptional. And when he spoke about them, his eyes lit up and he just had this, despite this horrific background, managed to build this beautiful family life. But the thing in terms of how it manifested in him is he couldn't hug people, he couldn't show love. And it wasn't just showing love, it was also mostly it was receiving love. And often as psychologists, we miss love as an intolerable emotion because we think it's a positive emotion, but not when you've experienced, when love has been linked with pain and trauma. So when people are abused in particular, they're dependent and reliant upon their caregivers to love them. And when love is linked with pain and abuse, then of course you take that into your adulthood and it becomes really difficult for you to both show and receive love, and love can feel, because it's linked with that, so love can feel intolerable. So for Mr. Man Who Couldn't Love, as I started to call him, he could never hug his kids.
He was scared with his new grandchild
he was going to become a sex offender, and that's why he couldn't hug his granddaughter. And that's what he said to me. He was able to cope with it with his kids because he, you know, kids and grandkids are different relationships, different attachment relationships. So with his kids, he did everything that showed he was a perfect dad. He fed them, he clothed them, he got them to school, he did all the things, but he never, ever, ever hugged them. They just gave up trying to even reach for a hug for their dad their entire lives. And then when he had his granddaughter and it continued on, he came to see me and he said, I can't hug my granddaughter. I just can't do it.
So what treatment did you suddenly come up with in this afternoon
In this afternoon in a remote Aboriginal community, right? So I did all the checking because I had a master's placement. I actually worked with sex offenders, interestingly enough. So I did all the checking and I kind of knew that there wasn't going to be any sort of that attraction to children purely based on the fact that he was just so, had so much insight and so much overwhelming self-control, you know, in terms of how he'd actually explain the whole thing to me. But I said to him, okay, neuroplasticity is an emerging field of psychology which tells us that 6 weeks of exposure-based therapy, things can actually normalise. So all you have to do is repeat, develop tolerance for the emotions that you fail to tolerate. So I basically said to him, okay, mate, you know, he's got a daughter that's worked in the local cafe in the community, and I said, okay, mate, we're going to go and hug your daughter. And it was like a paralysed cat. And I said, no, get in the car, we're going to go and hug your daughter. And off we go in this car, and he's sort of looking at me. He's got you know, hands on the dashboard sort of thing. And just so happened that she walked out of the cafe at the time we were driving on the road, and I knew it was her because she looked like him. And I said, is that your daughter? And he goes, yes. He was almost too afraid to admit it. So I just pulled over and I go to this woman I've never met before. I said, my name's Tracy. Your dad's going to hug you. And she's going like, who the hell are you? And she's going, my dad doesn't hug me. And so I said, come on, off you go, hug your daughter. And you look like a wine barrel, Sarah. It was like this. And I said, mate, that's the most pathetic hug I've ever seen. Do it again, right? And then as she was giggling away, Mr. Man Who Couldn't Love's daughter, I said, now your job, your homework is to make your dad hug you every single morning when he wakes up. But he has to extend his tolerance levels for 10 seconds each time. And then in the evening, he's got to hug you again. And he's got to extend his tolerance for 10 seconds. So each time, and I said, can you make him do that? That's your homework. And Mr. Man Who Can't Love, I was bossing him around too. And I said, that's what you have to do. That's your homework every day. Just do that. And that's all I did. And 2 weeks later, I get, even now, I get, you know, it's an emotional sort of conversation, but I get this phone call and from Mr. Man Who Couldn't Love. And all I can hear in the background is this beautiful little gurgling sound of a little baby. And he said, guess what? And I said, what? And he goes, I've got my granddaughter on my lap. And I said, yeah, I can hear a little gurgling sound of a little baby there in the background. And he goes, oh, I've had her on my lap for 2 hours and I can't stop hugging her. And I said, mate, you've got a lifetime of hugs to make up for. You hug the hell out of that kid. And then a week later, he rang me again and he said, you know, I didn't think I could fix this about myself just from practicing. And that's the thing about life, you know, you can, change can occur at any time. You just have to believe it's possible. And the reason why this man is so extraordinary is that he could have signed off on that life that he had. He'd married his childhood sweetheart. He'd raised 5 beautiful kids. But what insight is that, Sarah, that he went, no, I actually want to be better. You know, I actually want to be able to show love, because you know what, if you show your kids love, then they can show their kids love. And what a great gift is that to give your kids.
Yeah. I'm so glad his paths crossed with yours afternoon.
I'm honoured with everyone that's ever crossed paths with me in terms of and allowed me into their lives, really.
You know, even as you're sharing that beautiful story, Tracy, it strikes me that one of the kind of golden rules of Western psychology, the psychologist is meant to be removed and this sort of blank space.
Yeah.
Why doesn't that work so well with Aboriginal
rights? Good luck with that. Good luck with that, you know, and this is the thing. It's interesting that self-disclosure, right? They say self-disclosure, you shouldn't self-disclose personal information and keep yourself separate from your client. Yeah, good luck with that. So self-disclosure, to me, the yardstick is self-disclosure is used when it's to the benefit of your client. That's the yardstick. If you're using your clients as your own therapy and you're trying to get through some trauma that you experienced, then of course that's not no longer helpful. But I use self-disclosure all day, every day with my clients, and the term that I use for it is blackfella conversations, right? So I can talk to racism because I've experienced it. I can talk to discrimination because I've lived it. So when an Indigenous person comes into me, your job as a psychologist or a counsellor is to get out the story. That's your job, is to get out the story. The second part of your job, though, is for people to feel as if you understand what it's like to be them, and they call that therapeutic alliance. But I call these things cultural empathy, right? And if you actually don't understand the story, then you can't get at anything. Now, the fact that I can talk to racism, I can talk to all these things that Indigenous people have lived, means that they have to work less hard to tell the story, right? And there's nothing worse than coming into a psychologist, because it's the hardest step to make is to make that decision to go and get help. We shouldn't be making it harder. So the fact that people have to work less hard to tell their story means that they can then spend much more energy getting at the strategies, you know. And so, yeah, to me, there's so many things that they teach you in psychology that is sometimes creating damage, you know, and it's teaching people things that are actually having the opposite effect with clients, and that is to shut them down rather than open them up.
You say that for psychologists working in communities, though, they're going to have to be able to withstand growling. What's growling mean?
Oh, man. So when you go to a community for the first time, elders will growl you. Now, this is very normal, and the number of people in my workshops that have had this light bulb moment around this have been extraordinary over the years, where people go, what are you doing here? And who are you talking to? And what are you doing here? And this is the elders, right? And you just have to do not interrupt the growl, because the growl will go on much longer. The role of the elders is to check you out and go, are you coming with good intent? Are you coming with... And so they'll rip you. And people will go, well, we won't come back then. Good riddance, you know. And so every community you go into, you'll cop a growl, right? And a growl can actually look like you go into a community and you have to sit with elders to get permission to work in that community. If you don't do that, you drive into a community, they'll send you around in circles, right? And you've seen this happen so many times. People go, oh, I'm looking for John Smith. Oh, he's just gone over there. And then you drive over there. And then they go, no, he's just gone over there. And then they'll drive over there. And then they're just laughing at you. And what that is, that's a growl as well. That's, we don't know who you are. You haven't sat with us. You haven't gotten permission to work in our community. So the thing with Aboriginal communities is that they are very much about process and protocol, whereas non-Indigenous people are very driven by content. I'm going to do this program, I'm going to deliver this and content. But Aboriginal people always say, yeah, but who have you talked to? Who have you got permission with? Who can vouch for you? So everything's about process and protocol. And they're kind of pretty prescriptive, I find, with communities. And now, you know, I've been doing this a long time. I follow a very, very, very specific process and protocol with every community I go into. And your work is so much easier when you do it.
When you were named West Australian Australian of the Year in 2018, you announced a scholarship for Aboriginal student psychologists, the Dr. Tracy Westerman Indigenous Psychology Scholarship. And it's now evolved into a national scheme. I think in 4 years you've granted something like 55 scholarships.
Yeah, just about to announce another 10, actually.
Tell me about it. What's your aim with this scholarship?
Look, it's really like most things I've sort of done in my life, I think. I just come up with an idea and don't really expect it's going to amount to much. And that's an example. Look, there aren't many times in my life where I've felt anger and frustration, and that was one of the times when the Fogliani Inquiry into 13 deaths by suicide of Indigenous young people in the Kimberley, right? And that was a fourth government inquiry, and I was expert witness at a couple. And the inquiry is just also the same thing. And frankly, they're a waste of time. They just buy government time to go, oh, we'd love to act on the suicides. However, we're waiting for the inquiry to come down. And then the inquiry comes down. They spend 18 months thinking about the inquiry. Meanwhile, you know, these poor bereaved Indigenous parents who, you know, bared their hearts and souls begging for support and help are just being forgotten because it's now been 4 years, so everyone's forgotten about that. And so I got really frustrated and I bothered to read through all the inquiries. They all concluded the same thing, Sarah, and that was that children were dying from what they referred to as system failure. And what that meant was a lack of access to culturally competent services, right? And there were so many heartbreaking stories of parents desperately trying to get their kids help and appointments being, you know, cancelled or not being able to access a psychologist or complex therapies. And I went, I can fix this. I'm an Aboriginal person. I'm a psychologist. I'm from a remote community. I get how hard it is to get access to good mental health treatment. And so I did something that went absolutely against every value I've been raised with, and I publicly announced that I was going to personally fund $50,000 for the Dr. Tracy Westerman Indigenous Psychology Scholarship Program. But I did it for a very deliberate reason, and I wanted to guilt other people into donating, you know, matching my money. And it worked, and we got a it took a while though, Sarah. Like anything you build from the ground up, there's a reason why people have very rarely built successful businesses or charities from the ground up with their own money. And don't forget, I was donating all my time as well as running my own businesses, you know, so I work for free. So people see the success now, but every cent I bled for. Yeah.
Tell me about the kind of students who are selected. Who's on those scholarships at the moment?
Yeah, this is what I can, you know, how many hours have you got, really? It's there's so many, they're all extraordinary, and, you know, you want every single one of them to be better than you, and they all are, right? We've got the first, you know, Indigenous psychologist from Halls Creek, male psychologist. He'll graduate at the end of this year to text us on. We've got the first Indigenous, one of the first ones from Derby, one of the highest suicide rates in Australia, Nikki McKenzie, who was enrolled in psychology in 2008. Was doing a unit at a time, and then we grabbed her. She was the OG of the scholarship, and we grabbed her, and she went from 51% to 75%, and she graduated in February this year. So then we've got Taylor Thompson, who was the one of the OGs of the scholarship as well. She graduated with her clinical master's, and we've just employed her in Julia. So we've gone a full circle from she started as a second-year student, and now she's a clinical psychologist registrar that we've just employed in Julia. So every single one of these students come from an environment in which no one ever expected them to do much with their lives. We're taking students, we've got three from Alice Springs, and we are basically getting students out of the highest risk communities in Australia, people from the highest risk communities in Australia, and making them into psychologists. So we're not, I regularly reject students who have distinctions. I want people who have the most gaps to close. So we don't select students based on grades. This program is incredibly unorthodox, and everything I do is unorthodox because business as usual, doing what's always been done, is not solving these problems. If business as usual was going to solve these problems, it would have solved it by now. So it's all pretty unorthodox, but it's working, you know.
Tracy, all these projects that you've got on the go, all these plates that are spinning, all the trauma that you hear day after day, running is one of the ways that you keep yourself sane. Tell me about the role marathons. Not just any running, not just casual jog around the block. Marathons, what role do they play in your life?
That's right. I have to run a marathon. I have to run a couple, you know. And it was actually cool because I met Robert DiCostello at the Australian of the Year, and I said he was like my childhood hero. And he was, I said, Deke, I've run three marathons. Can I officially call myself a marathon runner? He goes, yes, you can. So I've got it from the top. I can actually call myself a marathon runner. Look, the running has saved my life.
Why? What do you mean?
Oh, look, it just, you know, people talk about self-soothing is what we talk about a lot. You know, we talked a bit about trauma and attachment through this conversation, and I can take on an enormous amount of stress, like enormous amounts of stress. And the reason why I can is because I've been able to link my stress with self-soothing strategies, and running is my self-soothing. And so I can be absolutely overwhelmed with the responsibility, overwhelmed with what's still to be done, overwhelmed with traumatic stories, overwhelmed with so many things. And I've linked that with going for a run. And I'll go for a run and life just seems much more manageable, always. And so it is my absolute, I'm so grateful for it. It has literally saved my life on many occasions, yeah. And if I don't run, I get sent off to run by my very cranky EA, my very bossy EA. She just goes, for God's sake, Tracy, go for a run, right? Yeah, cranky Tracy. They call me cranky Tracy, but that's good though, because cranky Tracy gets a lot of work done, but cranky Tracy sometimes, I have a cranky run sometimes, we call it.
But you come back in a better mood.
I'm completely better mood. But, you know, I also accept, Sarah, I think there's this thing that sometimes we, you know, high-achieving people or even people who are, you know, mums, dads, people have got a lot on their plate, we don't allow ourselves to just, I have a meltdown once a month, right? I have a meltdown once a month. I don't judge it. I don't feel bad about it. I don't feel guilty about it. I just accept that I'll just have a meltdown at least once a month. And I just go, look, I just feel overwhelmed. I feel that it's too much. And so I accept that. And I don't, a lot of people kind of go, look, I should, you know, how do I prevent myself from, you know, falling into a heap? Just don't judge it. Just allow it to happen.
So interesting. And that falling into a heap, you can get up again.
Yeah, of course you do. Of course you do, because you have to, right? But it's also that thing that you give yourself permission to actually feel how we feel. And I say that to my clients every day, that you need to give yourself permission to feel what you need to feel. So if I can't model that in my own life, I wouldn't be a very good psychologist, right? Of course you're going to find things hard, and of course it's going to be tough.
It's really just an honour to meet you, Tracy, and hear about your extraordinary work. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. It's been awesome.
Dr. Tracy Westerman was my guest on Conversations today, and her new memoir is called Jillia. And if you go along to Tracy's website, there's links to lots of the programs she's connected with, including that scholarship scheme. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara people. The executive producer of Conversations is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.